We're live and we're local. This is a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, August 8th, 2018. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and on today's show, we'll hear all about the Project Playground Community Build coming up August 8th through the 12th. That's today. Get details on the Jump Society Film Festival starting tomorrow through August 11th, and find out how you can participate in the Juno Opioid Workgroup Survey, as well as how to safely dispose of leftover prescription drugs and much more. Those interviews, National Native News, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast for the rest of today, rain with highs around 60 degrees and east wind to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, rain, maybe heavy at times, lows in the mid-50s. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Sharice David's Ho-Chunk secured the Democratic nomination for the 3rd Congressional District after the primary election in Kansas Tuesday. Supporters gathered for a watch party last night, eager to see the results, which took longer than expected and were still unofficial as of early Wednesday morning. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
It took until the day after the primary that numbers showed Ho-Chunk tribal member Sharice Davids over Brent Welder for the Democratic nomination in Kansas's 3rd Congressional District. The first sign things weren't going so well was when a voter tweeted that she was still in line after 8 p.m. waiting to vote. In response, the Johnson County Election Office tweeted, "We experienced high voter turnout in Johnson County today. We are delaying our reporting of results until we can confirm all voters in line have cast their votes." The delay had Lori Schell a little upset due to the county spending $10 million on new voting machines.
I know so many people that are voting for her, and she just seems so special. And it's frustrating that Johnson County, you know, the rich county, can't get its act together. It's like, what the heck? How much money did you spend on those things? And this is what's happening?
Sharice Davids, for her part, was optimistic throughout the night, thanking her supporters and predicting what could happen in November. Davis tweeted after 8 a.m., "The Kansas City Star has called it. I'm humbled to be your Democratic nominee in Kansas's 3rd District." The tally, Sharice Davids, 22,891, to Brent Welder, 20,803. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
U.S. House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi campaigned for Deb Haaland Tuesday in Albuquerque. Haaland from Laguna Pueblo is running for New Mexico's 1st Congressional District. Pelosi, Haaland, and Native women's advocates addressed violence against women at the event. They mainly discussed unique challenges facing tribes, saying more needs to be done, which includes securing key provisions for Indian Country in the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. Advocates are seeking protections for children and greater jurisdiction over non-Native offenders. In Utah, a Navajo man will be put back on the ballot. The Salt Lake Tribune reports a federal judge Tuesday ruled San Juan County officials improperly removed Willie Gray Eyes as a candidate for the county commission. His voting rights are being restored, and his name is being ordered back on the November ballot. County officials said he did not reside in the county, but Gray Eyes and Native rights groups claimed underlying racism and Native voter suppression. Three men were arraigned Tuesday in federal court in Albuquerque for conspiracy and theft from the United States. The men are accused of purchasing thousands of dollars of goods and services between 2013 and 2016 for personal use with credit cards intended for the Bureau of Indian Education. Simon Nunez, David Parrish, and Leland Martinez entered not guilty pleas and were released pending trial, which has not been scheduled. The charges carry a maximum of 5 years in prison and thousands of dollars in fines. The Gila River Indian community and its attorneys are applauding a federal court's dismissal of a lawsuit challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act. The lawsuit was filed in 2015 by the Goldwater Institute, representing parents involved in Arizona adoptions. The law is intended to keep Native children with Native families. The Gila River Indian community says this week's ruling is a victory for tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwantung Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
Support by the American Indian Tourism Conference, providing technical resources and education to advance and develop tourism programs in Indian Country. Registration available at AITC2018.com or at the conference.
And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska, and online at Sanofsky.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. And today my first guest is Alexander Pierce, or Alex, here to talk about Project Playground. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I was wondering if you could, in addition to introducing yourself, tell me how you're connected to this effort, Project Playground.
So I am a project manager with the City and Borough of Juneau. I work in the Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm connected to the project professionally. When the playground caught fire, I was one of two project managers tasked with working with the community to get the playground rebuilt and managing the contract for the insurance funds that funded the project.
So Project Playground, for those who don't know, has quite the backstory. Would you like to tell us that story?
Yeah. So in 2007, the original playground was built by volunteers, and it was a two-week effort. It took a couple of years for them to fundraise all the money for the original playground, and they had hundreds and hundreds of volunteers out every day over 2 weeks to completely build the playground. And it was a very loved community asset. So many local kids grew up playing there. And when the playground burnt down, there was really kind of an outpouring of grief in the community. We did a public meeting in the aftermath of the fire, and there was a lot of community grief, a lot of really sad kids there, and a lot of resolve and excitement to rebuild the playground and make it better than ever.
Do you remember where you were when you first heard about the fire?
I remember I was running down the Gastineau Meadows Trail after going for a run on the Treadwell Ditch, and I could just see this like black smoke billowing up into the side, and I thought the whole Mountainside subdivision was on fire.
Oh my goodness.
At first. And then I got down and got in my car and turned on the radio and heard that it was Project Playground, and thought, you know, as somebody who works in the Parks and Rec Department, oh God, this is one of our parks. Like, what happened? What's going to be a fallout with this? Was anybody hurt? Were there kids on the playground? It's like 7 o'clock at night. It's a nice night. Like, I just thought of all the possibilities. And the next morning, I went into work and learned that no one was hurt, and what happened, and that the cause of the fire was teenagers playing with fire, and that we had a lot of work to do to figure out how to help heal the community and what we needed to do to rebuild it.
It was a very big and scary-looking fire, for sure.
It really
Huge
was.
Flames, tons of black smoke. You know, the photographs were very dramatic. And for those who are wondering, it actually happened on Monday, April 24th, 2017. So just a little bit over a year ago, really.
Yeah, just a little over.
And now, like a phoenix, a new playground is literally rising from the ashes. So tell us about the new playground. What's it going to be like from what you know?
Well, the new playground will be pretty similar to the old playground. I'm sure everybody has driven by and seen the familiar blue ice castle back up on the hill there.
Cool.
And the difference is that there's some extra stuff. There's some new a zip line. There's a little turf field. There's a thing called an Omni Spinner that's kind of a modern merry-go-round. The swing sets are different. We have more prefabricated playground equipment in this playground than the last one. And The ice castle is a little bit more open. It's a little easier to see kids. We've done what we can to reduce the number of hidey holes that were in the original playground. That was something that parents were concerned about. We've tried to make the playground safer overall. We have made the playground more ADA accessible overall. The entire surface of the playground will be the poured in place material. So as opposed to the chipped rubber that was on the playground before, the people who are familiar with it, there was chipped rubber and then there were pathways that were kind of solid rubber. And the entire surface will be that solid rubber now. So someone with a mobility issue can access the entire playground, and that's important and also great for our park maintenance crews who don't have to go out there in the mornings and leaf blow the little chips of rubber off of the poured in place pathways.
that's good thinking. Do you worry about the possibility of another fire or lightning doesn't strike twice?
I think, of course, you can. You worry about things like that in the back of your mind, but I guess I worry about it in the same way that I worry about a fire living in an old house in downtown Juneau, which burned down periodically, it seems, more than other parts of town. I think that the reaction of the community to this and the outpouring of support and grief hopefully taught a lot of kids some valuable lessons about playing with fire and how it can get out of hand. So hopefully at least this generation has learned
some serious consequences from playing with fire. Well, that's great. And so what you're actually here to talk about today is the community rebuild. And I know that's sort of a project of the steering committee. So can you tell us a little bit about the steering committee and then we'll talk about the details of the rebuild?
Yeah. So when the fire happened, we assembled the remaining members of the steering committee who got the playground built in the first place. It was important to involve and include them because it was really a labor of love for them, and it was something that was built by volunteers and then given over to the city. But on the other hand, it was our insurance that covered the fire, so we needed to also be involved in managing the funds and the contracts. So we convened a group of people, and it grew as they added more members. And they have done all of the legwork for the community build. They've worked really hard to recruit volunteers and given input on the design. They've had kids out painting panels at fundraisers and raised a whole ton of money for all these great improvements that I was talking about. The zip line, the turf field, there'll be a really cool entry plaza that's all painted and give kind of an exciting sense of welcoming to the new playground, the port in place. That all came from generous donations by the community, and the steering committee was really responsible for going out and getting a lot of that money. And they are organizing this community build that's happening now. It was important to people to have an opportunity to rebuild the playground just like it was built last time. So from today and through Sunday, three shifts of volunteers a day at 8 a.m., 12:30 p.m., and 5:30 p.m. People can come down, no construction experience necessary, and help rebuild the playground. I was out there this morning, and I did everything from running a router to labeling where pickets were going to go and running all over site, wrangling volunteers. So it's a lot of fun, and people are going to be well fed as well. Lots of generous donations from local restaurants for food.
That's great. Actually, when you said pickets, it made me think of another question I wanted to ask. What are the pickets? Tell us about those.
So the original playground, for those who are familiar with it, had names on pickets, and those were sold as a fundraiser. So that fundraiser came back, and we have been selling, or the steering committee has been selling pickets for the past several months, and they're still selling them. There's still about 500 that can still be engraved. So you can go to goprojectplayground.org and fill out a picket form and still send it in through the community build, and so that ends Sunday, and get your name or whatever message you want to fit into, I believe it's like 16 or 19 characters,
short.
On the playground. Yeah.
And then I know there's been a lot of support, both moral and financial, from the community, local businesses. Anybody you think deserves special thanks or recognition while you're here today?
Oh, I would hate to forget somebody. We've had a lot of support from businesses. Right after the fire, Alaska Airlines really stepped up. The Northwest Cruise Line Association really stepped up. Rasmussen has donated money. There's a Dr. Brown Memorial matching funds that came up with a great deal of money from local physicians. I am absolutely positive that I'm forgetting lots of major donors. So if you're out there, please accept my apologies. We will have donor recognition on a sign at the playground so people can see who contributed. And we had a lot of great individual donations from generous community members and smaller donations from businesses, lots of in-kind donations, businesses that wanted to contribute materials and tools and things. And like I said, lots of local restaurants, IGA donated a lot of food, and they're feeding all the hungry volunteers on site right now.
That's great. Well, shout out to all those folks you mentioned and more. Rebuild Project Playground is going on all day, every day, beginning today, and goes through the 12th. No experience necessary. Older kids can even help. Refreshments provided. Everybody, every little bit helps, so please show up.
Every little bit helps. You know, rain or shine, come out. We need all the volunteer help that we can get. It's a big project, and it's a lot of fun.
Project Playground is located at Twin Lakes. If you don't know where it is, ask somebody. More information on the Facebook page and go projectplayground.org. Alex Pierce, thank you so much for being here today. Anything else you'd like to add?
You're so welcome. Nope, just please come out and volunteer. And we really appreciate the support that Juno has given us so far. And we look forward to many years of having a really amazing playground for our kids to grow up and play.
Thanks for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Lose. village of Nutok in western Alaska is about to disappear. The land it was built on is eroding away, threatening not just the village, but a way of life.
Essentially, what you're really talking about is the preservation of the Yupik community, its traditional values, its identity.
Lessons from Nutok on the next Midnight Oil. Available Thursday at ktoo.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bird Note. What's the reddest bird on the continent? In the east, the velvety red scarlet tanager is a favorite. Maybe the summer tanager, though neither is seen in the open nearly as often as the respectably red northern cardinal. But in the southwest, another candidate pops out like a bright red flare on the tip of a branch. The vermilion flycatcher. Compared to shy scarlet tanagers and skulky cardinals, a vermilion flycatcher is a true showman. The male dashes out to capture butterflies and bees, then perches right at eye level on an open branch. To sing its best to females and rival males, it hovers, butterfly-like, 50 feet in the air, a fluttering beacon of crimson. The dashing vermilion flycatcher evokes sparkling names wherever it's found, from the arid southwest to South America, Mosquero cardinal, or cardinal-colored flykiller, and Bracita de Fuego, or little red-hot coal of fire. Even its scientific name, a title bestowed by sober museum experts, bows to its flash, Pyrocephalus rubinus, the ruby firehead. You'll find an amazing video of a pair of nesting vermilion flycatchers when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
The sky is blue most every day. The land.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. It's about 25 minutes after the hour. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my next guests are all here representing the Jump Film Society. So we were just listening to Jumpers by Sleater-Kinney. And so welcome to the show, Anton Duran, Aaron Suring, and Jamie Karnick. So I hope I pronounced all those names all right.
Hello.
Work was good for me.
All right, good. Thanks for being here. So you're here to talk about the Jump Society Film Festival, and what does Jump stand for?
Jump is the Juno Underground Motion Picture Society.
Nice. And it's I've been to the film festival before, so I know
Excellent.
It's a series of short films. But why don't you guys tell us a little bit about Jump Film Festivals? What are they? Who participates? Who attends? Et cetera.
So it's a local film festival, and our only real rules are is it has to be Juno-related and less than 10 minutes. And so it's just kind of like an idea to see who's out there making films in Juno. So we're a 501c3 nonprofit. We've done that for like a couple of years now. It's pretty a big deal. We've been around since 2002, so it took us a long time to get there. But our mission is to support Juno filmmakers. And if you're making short films, it's really hard to get a whole crew together, an audience together to come see like a short 5-minute movie. So if we package them all together, then that was the idea, was to get people to come out to see a whole bunch of different films and see what people are doing, what people are making.
Brilliant. It works.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It is fun.
And the best part is admission is free, so that's a good thing to point out right off the bat.
Sure, yeah.
And it takes place
Everybody's welcome.
Yeah, it takes place at Gold Town Nickelodeon. That's on Shattuck Way. Bless that Costa. So what are some of the films this time that you would like to highlight?
Well, Anton's here to talk about some of the stuff he's made. He's
so
made a
Anton
couple, he has a couple films in this film, festival.
Oh, great. Well, tell us all about it.
All right. I have to ask Aaron. He said a couple.
Oh.
Is the promo in there?
Yeah.
Okay. So, well.
Yeah. Talk about that. That'd be a great thing to talk about.
I'll start out talking about the promo. We did this. We have this. Well, the Jump filmmakers get together once a month, and we'll go out and we'll just film anything. And it's just for practice and so that we can learn different filmmaking techniques and things like that. And we just started doing this, and one of the first things we did was a promotional film. So we all went. We went over to the Seawalk over by the
New Whale.
The New Whale, yes. And we spent an afternoon, and we filmed something. Filmed this promo, and it's in the Jump Festival.
What's it a promo for?
Well, it's for filming once a week, for the once a month. Filmmaking thing.
It's okay.
Getting
together
where we get together.
It's a short film about making short films.
Right.
Exactly.
It's a short film about doing what we were doing. So it's
got to go deeper.
Yes.
Nice.
So that's one thing that's in Jump. And David Purdy, he edited it.
Oh, he works here.
Yes, he does. Uh-huh. He edited it together, and it was just wonderful. We were all really amazed when we saw it. So it's he just did a great job of putting together the footage. It was really amazing. The other thing that I have in the Jump Festival is I've been experimenting with 16mm film, and my dad gave me a 16mm Bolex about a year ago. And so I've been playing with that, and I have another Bolex camera. And so I thought, wouldn't it be great to get together a group of people, kind of like with the filming, once a month filming, but to have a Bolex filming day. So we'll take the 16mm camera and we'll go out and use actual film. Because everything is, digital now.
Yeah, as I say, I don't know much about what you're saying.
Yeah, I've actually never shot on film.
Everything's done digitally these days. This sounds kind of retro, kind of vintage.
Yes. It's very vintage and very retro. A Bolex camera is a wind-up 16mm movie camera that was made. I think they started making them in the 1940s, and they continued making them. They're very popular, and they continued making them right up through the 1970s, various different revisions of the same model. Very reliable, very tough, mechanically tough. I mean, my dad sat in his shop for 40 years and it worked perfect.
Wow.
Took it out.
They don't make them like they used to.
No. Right?
And everything I'd done had been digital. And so I thought, well, it'd be really neat to do something with actual old-fashioned movie film. So we had one roll of 3-minute film, and that's not a lot to film with. And I thought, what kind of story can we do with 3 minutes of film? And I realized we were probably only going to get about 10-second shots of film from the time we start the camera till we stop it out of that roll. Now, obviously, that doesn't add up to 3 minutes. But when you factor in you know, going a little bit over here and there, and the amount of time that it takes to, you know, there's some error there. And so it's like, yeah, 10 second shots. So I thought, okay, what can we do? Let's not even try to tell a story. Let's do something a little more random. So I created a bunch of sticky notes, and I wrote down the camera angle, and I wrote down the location, sublocation from like a, like we filmed it in Cope Park. And so like there's over by the swings is a location. The stairs are a location. The dog park is a location. Anyway, so I wrote all that down on little sticky notes. And then I wrote some what I was calling dialogue seeds down on some other sticky notes. And I put numbers on these sticky notes. And then I got some D&D multi-sided dice. And we got together in a room, and the sticky notes were on the table, and we rolled the dice, and whatever number came up was what camera angle it was going to be, what location, and what dialogue, and also we did what characters. So it was completely random. And then we stuck the sticky notes up in the different scenes on the whiteboard, and that was what we filmed.
And how did that turn out?
It's
pretty random.
Yeah. You'll have to come to the jump fest. Come to the jump fest and find out.
Yeah, I do want to see it now that I know the origin. Because with that type of film, I'm guessing it's you just get one chance.
Yeah, Everything was one take. That was all we had. Like I said, we only had 10 second shots. Yeah. And so it was like one take. We did manage to squeeze two extra shots out of the roll. So we did a couple of close-ups that we didn't have planned. But everything in the short that we did was randomly generated by rolling the dice, and so it's interesting.
So, what did you learn from this experiment?
A couple of things. You get a group of people into a room, and you ask them to come up with a story. It can take a very long time to you know, with everybody sort of arguing back and forth, and various egos in the room wanting to do certain things. But when it's rolling a dice, everybody gets a turn, you know, they can all roll the dice, and we accept whatever the roll comes up with. It takes the ego out of story making, and everybody gets to participate. And so there were five of us that did this, and we all five got a say in how it was going to be put together. Now, granted, the results are a little random, yes, but it was a lot of fun. I think everybody had a lot of fun with it.
I think I'm going to have fun watching it, too, now that I
There's definitely smiles.
The story behind it. How's the quality of the film? Does it look good?
Well, yes. The 16-millimeter film, one of the things about film is it has some – well, maybe not so much anymore, but digital is really catching up. But film has some benefits, the look of it, the way it renders colors and dynamic range, which – anyway, it looks really nice. And I was real happy with the way the images came out. There was a little bit of noise in the film that I had to get rid of, but because we were using an old roll. But
well, that's part of film too. Film has some noise to it, and that's kind
it
of
does.
The grain of the film actually kind of adds to the.
Did you have to submit a digital copy to Jump for this film festival?
Oh, well,
absolutely.
I'm going to explain one thing about film. You film it in your camera, and then when the roll runs out. You go to a dark place, you take out the roll, you put it into a dark container, and then you mail it off to a place that develops it. And they'll develop it, and they will also scan it into digital files. Now, this might sound a little weird.
It's kind of like with the old-school cameras. I mean, there'll also be a film, too, and it would just be one shot at a time, and this is multiple shots. So
I remember dropping off film to get developed when I was a kid.
But there's no place in town that does that, so you have to send it away now.
Oh, interesting.
So it comes back.
Wow, that's really a relic of the past.
It is.
God, when did I get old?
So it comes back in a couple of weeks as a digital file, and you put it in your computer. And then
they also gave you the film too, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And you get the negative back. And I actually have a 16-millimeter projector, but it's a negative that you get back. You can pay to have a positive film,
made,
one
yeah.
that you can actually project made, but it's extra money, and I didn't want to do that. But then you work with the digital file, and you edit that together and submit it to Jump.
Very interesting. Thank you for all of that information. Jamie Karnick, we haven't heard much from you. What's your role in Jump?
I know, it's rare, isn't it? Just over here all quiet.
Do you have a film in the festival?
I do not have a film in this festival. I think I've had some in past festivals. I'm on the board. As Aaron said, we recently became a 501c3, so there's now about an 8 or 9 member board,
which is nice. He's just going to be.
There's nine of us.
Nine of us.
It's
I
not
can
eight
never
or one.
Tell. You know. Yeah. Well, it depends on whether I'm still on
oh,
it
right.
from week
we
to week.
We haven't kicked you off yet.
I know. Yeah. A lot of probationary stuff for me. So I participate in helping get the word out. We are start. You know, as a 501c3, it's really been an interesting process. I think for us to move from Pat and Aaron and then Lou Logan, sort of putting this together, the three of them, to having a larger group and trying to think a little bit more about what Jump's about and where we're heading, how we want to inspire more filmmaking, how we want to help give people the resources they need to make their own movies and a place to show them and maybe even hear about them from folks too. So that's – I do that, and then I mostly just make sure Aaron gets to the radio station on time.
Mm-hmm. Good job.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yep, thanks for doing that.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a question for the whole panel. What is the most memorable short film that you ever saw at Jump?
Whoa.
Ooh.
Well, there's been a lot of them, and I remember there was one with this cabin that was up in the woods and this crazy guy in the cabin. Do you know what one I'm talking
You're
about?
You're talking about a Paul Disney film.
I do.
Yeah, I think
yeah.
so. Yes.
I sure do.
And I remember that one. That one stuck out in my mind.
Get under your skin a little bit.
It's that Cozy Shack.
Yes.
that was a good one. He had some great faces in that one, too.
I remember seeing one that was kind of fashioned like a PSA, but real, you know, a bit crude, and had some animation in it. It was about warning people about teaching kids that Alaska and Hawaii, or that Alaska particularly, is an island off the southwest coast of the United States because of where it's frequently placed
on
maps.
Yeah.
Yeah, not very big and super tropical. Yeah.
Anyway, that's the one that sticks out to me, even though I've seen a lot. And anyway. Okay, here's another question for the panel. What film went on to be the most successful outside of Juno?
Wow.
That's a good question. I know Joel Bennett did Talking with Mr. Darby, and that went and played at a bunch of different film festivals down south. Greg Chaney submitted a smaller version of a film that he took around to like Banff and some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe one of those two. I know, I don't know. Well, maybe Dave Hunsaker did a great film with a knight too. What's that?
Anton's pointing at himself.
Yeah. What? Tell me.
Well,
tell me about
he's
the,
whispering
what,
something to
oh,
Aaron.
Sorry.
What's
my
your
my own little ego says? Oh well, what about Space Trucker Bruce?
Space
but
Trucker
it wasn't
Bruce.
Actually in Jump. It was I put some previous right. music videos yes. of it in Jump. So yeah.
Okay, I've seen that one too. Actually.
Yeah.
I get around.
That won a whole bunch of awards, right? Didn't it?
Yes, it won some awards at film festivals, and it's on YouTube and Amazon Prime right now, and lots of people are watching it and saying good and bad things about it.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty funny.
That's what you say about any Jump festival. It's like, so there's good things and bad things to say about
it's
all of them.
It's good and bad
as long
and weird.
Good in there,
and we'll make
good.
Sure we'll take care of that this time, too. There's good and bad in this one.
And
all right. And
interesting and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the other films I want to point out is that we're going to have the last of the Kanan Bosler, his A Trip South. He did 10-minute, a whole bunch of those. About his trip from Juneau, kayaking and biking all the way down to the tip of Argentina. And so the last of those is in this festival too. So,
those are great. That was probably actually my second most memorable film that I've seen at Jump. That one stood out to me. I remember that. And was here last week.
Yeah, it's a whole series of them. Yeah, right. I mean, he did his kind of smushed together version last week. And it was really fun to see that. But you're like missing some of the individual stories that you get in this, in these individual breakout ones that are pretty fun.
Yeah, he did a good job on that.
Yeah.
All right, so what are the dates and times for the festival this time?
Thursday, August,
9th.
9th, huh. Yes, thank you. I got August right. Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m., Friday, August 10th at 7 p.m., and then Saturday, August 11th at 4 and 7 at the Gold Town. There will be beer at the Friday and Saturday shows if anyone wants those.
Cool.
Yeah, we're not doing any late shows this time, but we are going to have a matinee on Saturday. We're trying something a little bit different. So.
Cool, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
The weather's right. And admission is free. I'm sure the beer is not, but that's good to have. And, it's all taking place at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. And more information on your website and Facebook?
Yep, absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, great. Yeah. Well, thanks for being here today, Anton, Aaron, and Jamie. Is there anything else you guys would like to add?
We both looked at Aaron. No.
Okay. Well, I mean, how much time do we have?
Zero.
Zero. Oh, well, then let's keep talking. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll be right back.
Come join the Juno Arts and Humanities Council for the 9th Summer Block Party of 2018 this Friday, August 10th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. in the Centennial Hall Courtyard or the Jack Main Hall if there's precipitation. Featuring belly dancing by the Daughters of the New Moon and fabulous drag with Gigi Monroe and friends, alongside lots of products from an exciting array of local Juno merchants. There will be a beer garden, lawn games, and a whole lot more fun. Celebrate the summer and support the new Jack, sponsored by the Juno Arts and Humanities Council.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. It's about 17 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and here with me in the studio is Jessica Spurrier. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon for the very first time.
Thanks so much, Shelley.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Also, your very first time on the radio.
Exciting.
So, yeah, I'll go easy on you, though. No gotcha questions. Not too many, anyway.
All right.
So, Jessica, you are the Coordinator for Partnerships for Success, and you're also the facilitator for the Juno Opioid Work Group. And you're here to talk about a survey and some other things related to opioids. But first, I just wanted to ask, you know, those are a couple big titles. Could you please say more about what you do in your roles for those respective organizations?
Absolutely. So Partnerships for Success is a federal grant that is looking at addressing the non-medical use of prescription opioids and heroin use in people ages 12 to 25 years old. JAMI is my employer, and JAMI is a subgrantee for the state of Alaska, which is who got the federal grant. So I work for JAMI coordinating this program, and a big part of that program is to develop a coalition of community members and professionals working in the field of opioids opioid treatment addictions and bring people together to work on this problem.
A couple follow-up questions there. Do you also work with like law enforcement, public health? Are those folks a part of the coalition?
They are, yes.
And my other question is why the focus on the 12 to 25 year olds?
That is a mandate from the grant. Uh-huh. That is the target population that SAMHSA is the organization that we've received our grant from, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And they have identified that as being the target population.
Any reason why, or do you know why?
I'm not sure.
I mean, it seems like a vulnerable age.
It
I imagine if you can nip it in the bud during those years,
absolutely,
you'll have fewer problems with adults. Okay, and then just a very basic question for those who don't know: what are opioids, and why are they a problem?
Sure, opioids are often referred to as painkillers. They include prescription medications such as morphine, codeine, methadone, oxycodone, hydrocodone, fentanyl. Some brand names might be Vicodin, Percocet, Oxycontin. And the problem with opioids is that they are they're very highly addictive. The longer research shows that the longer that you take a prescription opioid, even if it is used appropriately as prescribed by your doctor, to treat pain, the greater the chance of addiction you have, and it's the data on that is pretty significant.
What's the status of the opioid crisis in Juneau? I know we've heard about it for a couple of years now. Is it still a crisis?
So I think using the word crisis is kind of a little bit loaded. There's definitely a problem. We have data showing most of our data comes from emergency department discharges, people that are admitted to the hospital for opioid-related poisonings and overdoses. So we are kind of constantly collecting that data. So as far as what's happening currently, the data that we have that we're working with most often is from 2015. So our data mm-hmm. is a little bit lacking, but that's going to be the next part of our grant is to get some new data.
So let's talk about that, because you're really here to promote a survey and spread the word about the survey so you can get as many people to participate as possible. What is it? What kinds of questions are you going to be asking? Who do you want to talk to? How will you use the data?
Absolutely. So Partnerships for Success is a five-year grant. The first 3 years are focused on assessment, community assessment, which we've done. There is then capacity building, which is building the coalition, and then strategic planning. And in that strategic planning, the Juneau Opioid Work Group identified several different factors of why opioid misuse is a problem in Juneau. In order to address those factors, the work group came up with several ideas. Some of those include a media campaign, getting out drug deactivation and disposal bags, working with prescribers to promote the CDC prescribing guidelines, promoting an online resource where people can go to get information on where they can get help.
Sorry, can we go back up a step?
Sure.
Could you say what were some of the factors that are some of the reasons why it's a problem in Juneau that you guys came up with?
Yep, absolutely. So one of the factors is retail availability of prescription opioids, meaning retail, meaning people get them from prescribing offices.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to combat that, we're working with prescribers to see if we can reduce the retail availability. If opioids aren't prescribed, then people don't generally get them.
Right. Makes sense.
Another factor is social availability. Social availability means in a short short sentence means finding them in someone's medicine cabinet. Mm. Opioids that are left over after treating pain, we want those to not be in people's medicine cabinets. If people don't and that's – I think that's where – that might be where the 12 to 25-year-old come in too, is young people looking through medicine cabinets and finding leftover opioids. So that's where our drug – our medication deactivation and disposal bags is coming in. So those were the two big factors that in regards to opioids specifically that we're looking to address through some of those strategies. And the survey to go back to that is looking this. So the first survey that we're doing is a baseline. Mm-hmm. We haven't, like I said previously, the first 3 years of the grant were kind of really behind the scenes, developing capacity and doing a bunch of research. And now we're starting to implement some of these strategies. So before we really get too involved in implementation, we want to get a baseline of where the community is at. So subsequent surveys can give us more information about what's working, what's not working, and if we need to tweak some of these strategies.
That sounds like a good plan. Have you been involved in these types of interventions in the past?
This is a very new position for me.
Yep.
So I just started in June, actually, with this coalition. And this coalition's been going since 2015. So I'm coming into it as a newbie.
So how are you going to reach out to the public to get this survey filled out? And do you have any audiences that you're particularly targeting?
Yeah. So we are targeting all adults in Juneau. And adults are, even though the grant is looking at 12 to 25 year olds, our strategies are targeting adults because those are the folks that generally, especially the social availability of opioids, that's where that's coming from. Mm-hmm. So we want to target adults. To take the survey, all you have to be is an adult that lives in Juneau. There's going to be several opportunities to take the survey. The first one, actually, the survey is going live tomorrow online and in person. We're going to be set up at Super Bear tomorrow from 11 to 1 at a table, and we are going to have tablets, just maybe two tablets. I thought I had three, but one stopped working today. So.
That happens.
So tablets, and we're going to be asking folks who enter the store to take a survey on a tablet. If they don't want to take the survey on a tablet, don't feel comfortable with that. We have paper surveys that are available. Then we are going to be at Foodland IGA on Friday from 11 to 1, the same situation. And the biggest thing about this survey is that if you take it, then you can enter into a drawing to win one of three $50 Visa gift cards.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then
that's
other
– good incentive.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And then the other opportunity is, of course, to take it online. We have – it's a SurveyMonkey survey. So I have going to post the link on our Facebook page and also on our website. So we just ask that if people are interested to go ahead and visit Juneau Opioid Work Group at Facebook and also JunoOpioidWorkGroup.org.
You are so organized. This is what a great effort.
Working on it.
Yeah. But if you take it online, do you still get entered into the contest to win
the
gift card?
Absolutely.
That's terrific.
And something important to know about the contest entry, too, is that it is anonymous. So even though you take it online, at the end of the survey, we have a link that takes you to a completely different survey where you can enter your phone number or your email address. And so that email address or phone number is not tied to the original survey in any way.
You guys thought of everything.
Yeah. We'll see.
No, I think that's a great idea. It's a good way to establish some baseline data and then see if your interventions are working. It makes a lot of sense to me. I used to work in public health.
Oh, so great.
And then another thing I wanted to ask you about while you're here is disposal of old medication, because I know you want to talk about this. I know some people rely on opioids for pain management and do not abuse them, but don't want them to get in the wrong hands. So how or where can people dispose of their opioids?
Absolutely. Great question. There are a few different avenues that someone could take to dispose of leftover prescription meds once their pain is managed. Of course, if someone needs to take opioids, you need to take them to manage pain. The first thing that you could do is take them to JPD and dispose of them in their medication disposal box, and that's available during business hours Monday through Friday. The other option is that you could use a drug deactivation medication deactivation disposal bag. Those are a black kind of Mylar bag, and they're about 5 inches by 8 inches. It has a zip top, and it, inside of it has some, I believe it's charcoal, that you put your pills or patches or liquid in, and then add some hot tap water, re-zip it, shake it up, and then you can throw it right in the trash. And you can get those disposal bags at Ron's Apothecary, Ron's in IGA, also Juno Drug, or Jamie's Pharmacy, Genoa. Or either of the Jamie clinics, the Salmon Creek or the Midtown Clinic, we will have the bags available as well.
That's great. That makes it really easy. And I've seen those bags. They look very simple to use.
Very simple. And what's great is that the medications are deactivated, so they are not going to be doing pollution.
Right. They don't go into the water supply or anything like that. Well, that's a great invention.
Amazing invention.
Yeah. Whoever thought that up. Jessica Spurrier, thanks for being here today. The survey goes live tomorrow. Take it at Super Bear on Thursday, tomorrow, 11 to 1 p.m., or take it at Foodland on Friday, August 10th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., or take it online, Juno Opioid Workgroup at Facebook, or junoopioidworkgroup.org for a link to the survey. It's anonymous, and you'll get entered to win a $50 Visa card, you said?
One of three $50
Visa cards. Well, sign me up. Thank you so much for being here today and sharing all that excellent information. Anything else you'd like to add before you go?
I think that's all. Thank you so much for having me, Shelley.
All right. You're welcome.
I won't just survive. Oh, you will see me thrive. Can write my story.
Thanks for tuning in today to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow, Kate Inge will be here with our weekly update from Juno Public Libraries. We'll get the details on the PEO Whale Watch Cruise and fundraiser. And we'll hear about the school supply drive sponsored by the Zach Gordon Youth Center. And, of course, Nancy DeCherney will be in with Arts Up. That's tomorrow live at 3 on KTOO. Juno Today Show will be available on demand online at ktoo.org. This has been a Juno Afternoon. Until tomorrow, have a great Juno evening.